to be a lovely month of considering these tremendous mysteries, these potentialities beyond with limits of any kind. We're very fortunate as seekers of truth in this day and age because we have a source of knowledge that has been accumulating from time immemorial and is continuing to bloom through our very humble efforts. We've been advised in this study of theosophy that there is a universal impress deep within the heart of the self-conscious entity, and that that impress of eternal verities bubbles up from time to time in minds and hearts of sages, sophisticated seekers, of which we may be followers or reflections, and that we can find this evidence throughout prehistoric eras of all types, in all places, among all peoples. We could, as individual students, study the mind and nature, the mysteries of mind by looking at architecture, by looking at symbols and glyphs in artwork, by looking at geometry and the use of numbers as symbols. We can observe great nature and biology and botany and in general. In the literate period of writing, we could look at legends and myths and allegories. Frequently, they start in oral traditions and then bloom in written form. In the West, we have a whole series of historical documented mystery schools. And we're very aware that in the modern world of religions and philosophies and sciences, there is a commonality of theme of an unknowable source behind, beyond, throughout all masks of gods that have been created by humans. But we're most fortunate because in the work of Blavatsky in the late 1800s, we got a bouquet, if you will, of insight into these various periods of time in which this knowledge was made available. Just as the Gita that we just heard is over 5,000 years old, so too the information about the mind and nature is ancient, 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 but was brought forth by Judge Blavatsky and others in the late 1800s. In the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, you can find commentary on stanza six. And the major point to be made there is that spirit, to become self-conscious, must pass through every cycle of being, finally culminating in its highest point on earth in the human state. Spirit per se is unconscious. It is an abstraction. It is an absolute. It is purity inherent. But it comes forth, as the Gita told us so beautifully just a few minutes ago, and is expressed throughout all points of intelligence in the cosmos, the universe, the earth, within ourselves. But we're reminded, what is this statement that we can find throughout history, throughout all peoples, throughout all places? Well, we're reminded that spiritual and intellectual evolution precedes all physical forms of evolution, that there is an abstract, absolute, all-encompassing, omniscient force, if you will, or unimaginable source of all that has no attributes, However, emanating from it, from this unknowable, unfathomable absolute, in an ebb and flow, in a spiraling pattern or cycle of periodicity, there comes forth an impersonal, universal, divine principle that is beyond conditioned, beyond cognitive formation of any kind, but invigorates eventually through evolution the human state and all kingdoms below the human state. This universal divinity has many different names depending on the time and the place and the thinkers that were working on expressing it. It is witness to the manifested universe. It is sometimes called universal mind. The soul of the universe is another term that we can find throughout history. It is said that within it, in the spiritual font, we would be able to imagine the holding of the design of all future evolution, of all states and planes. It is thought divine, universal, without limit. It's been called the Anima Mundi, the Mahat Akasha, Brahma's Aura, Alaya. Plato, in the modern historical period in the West, termed it a perpetually reasoning divinity. And his work was based on the preceding Pythagorean work, in which the abstraction was expressed in number and geometry. Theosophy, the divine wisdom, the spiritual wisdom, is an expression of that generality of soul consciousness. And theosophy, it enables us, empowers us indeed, to use a basis of visualization of evolution and how it came forth. So we have the abstract absolute, a first evolutionary expression or emanation of idea, but in unmanifested mind, truly ethereal, beyond human comprehension in many ways. There's a second unfolding, if you will, and that is idea as a reflection of that universal mind, and it is often called the manifested logos. So the idea gradually begins to be expressed, gradually takes on ethereal form, before finally, in a third stage of evolution, ideation is clothed in matter, primordial at first, astral indeed, gradually densifying, if there is such a word, in the matter of the objective plane in which all of us are functioning. This universal mind moving through these stages of expression is the source of mind or manas in the human state. Sometimes that's called Kshetrajna, and that could be an individual study that you might be interested in. But it's a spiritual ego, individuality, self-conscious entity that certainly came to bloom as we have begun to express it 18 million years ago. And in our own daily thinking and use of mind, we can consider anchor phrases like thou art that to express that our particularized mind, soul, is a reflection of that far loftier, far more ethereal, far more complex and yet homogeneous spiritual source. This is said to be a continuous, unbreakable chain from above to below, from below back again. A complete continuity, if you will, of mind in nature. The scientist Herbert Spencer wrote that there's a gradual change that's unknown to most of us, moving from the homogeneous to the heterogeneous. But that throughout, as Blavatsky states, there are various powers in the lower early kingdoms that begin to be expressed, gradually accumulate, and then begin to snowball until finally they culminate in the human state. But throughout all, mind is mysterious, but yet a reality. The wind is a great mystery. The movement of air across the planet is a great mystery, but we know it by its effects. We may not know the abstract source and force, but we see and we can understand the effects. We could use the analogy of electricity, a great, amazing source of power that can be particularized and used. The potential, the potency, the universality of it is mysterious in many ways, but electricity needs a condition. It needs a focus. It needs an instrument to convey its power. And it does so expressed through endurance, in degrees, in radiations. We know that depending on the wattage of a light bulb, we'll get different degrees of light and heat and power. The electricity is one, and yet the expression is limited by the conditioning of the instrument available. And in that way, we can begin to envision that monad, that monadic essence, the vivifying agent between spirit and matter, that is an emanation of these early stages of evolution, but which come forth as a life force out of the universal and begin to express in all the degrees of nature. Mind, the monastic essence, the monad, begins to be able to be more and more expressed depending on the degree of the conditioning that's been achieved. You can make a study of the SD, many different articles. There's a wonderful article by Blavatsky. She wrote that in 1896. It's entitled The Mind in Nature, and it summarizes how mind essence begins to be expressed. So if we think about the proposition that there's a sevening, a sevenfold evolutionary process, in the very, very first ethereal states, it is said that there are elemental minerals still as in that homogeneous pre-astral state in certain ways, latent life, latent mind, latent spirit, but gradually, gradually, gradually developing the instrumentation needed for the ultimate design of evolution. In the second class or kingdom that we can imagine, mineral as we know it today, there's a hardening, there is a densification of the matter being used. And that monadic essence is said to be imprisoned. Mind, spirit is imprisoned within the concrete formation of the mineral. As thinkers, how can we imagine mind in the mineral state? Minerals, except for possibly liquid mercury, really don't move around by themselves. But there is an expression of intelligence. There is cohesion. Goodness only knows the mineral state really knows how to hold a specific form based on the design of in great nature. There is a degree of intelligence and attraction, magnetism. We know that we can see remarkable patterns of filings responding to magnets. We have gold as a mineral, tremendously pure, that in its own degree of strength and purity never rusts. It's changeless. It can be altered by humans, but as a mineral, it is incredibly pure, incredibly strong. And then we have the vegetative state, the plant state, that's frankly has the expression of sensitivity to light, to finding water, to bending in the wind, to using the wind to express seeds, to pollinate, and to further sustain plant life on the world as we know it. There's been much in modern science, much research done that in the vegetable state, in vegetation, we find sensation, reaction to light, to water, and to sound and to thought. There is a memory, there's a strong memory in the seed of vegetation itself. We have many scientifically explored cases of ancient seed found in caves, thousands of years old, that when finally brought into the correct conditions for life and growth, spontaneously come alive and follow set patterns of growth to bloom, to fruit, and then to reseed once again. Again, they may not be individually mobile, but the expression of life, the reaction to the environment is clear. In the animal kingdom of great nature, we see a further development, a whole array of expression of mind that's made possible based on the animal condition itself. We see the role of instinct, of parenting, of survival, of following set patterns in order to maintain survival, to reproduce. We see the ability to move. And again, that movement is based on a finite, particularized degree of desire, if you will, operating uniformly under the law, the symmetrical law of instinct. But there's a range of learning available. There is a range of nurturing that's available. In the animal state, some burst forth, completely able to survive on their own, almost as orphans in a certain way, while in other animal states, we see child rearing, if we can use that term, that's akin, that seems to be an echo or precursor of what goes on in the human state. But throughout those lower states, mineral, vegetative, and an animal, we see a limited degree of the monad. We see Atma, Buddhi, as the Easterners would tell us. It is only in the fourth stage of development of evolution, in the human state, that we see the culmination. We know that within even the densest human form, we have mineral expressed, we have a vegetative expression, we have, if you will, an animal expression. All of the earlier degrees of mind, whether it is cohesion, the strength of our bones, whether it is sensation and our reaction to light and to water and to the environment in general. We have the instinct for survival and the instinct of when and how to behave in certain ways. All of that begins to culminate in the human state, the human form, physical and astral. But in the human state, we have mind able to express itself in the loftiest manner available on this particular plane of existence. We sense within the interior the duality of soul mind, buddhi manas, as well as that lower instinctual mind of the animal state, kamma manas. And we know that there is a lit up aspect to the shadowy model of mind that we can see in the lower kingdoms. In the animal and in the human state, there's a link between spirit, mind, and matter, and that is the psychic, the astral, that exists throughout all of great nature, in man and in great nature alike. The range of forces of nature, the sympathetic and involuntary in the plants, the instinctual in the animals, the impulse, habit, highest intellection and intuition that exist in the human state. These are all ranges of the mystery of mind as it exists throughout all of matter. And again, we're reminded that spirit, to be ever becoming toward its bloom of self-consciousness, must pass through every cycle of being, exist in and through every cycle of being. And so we have deity in nature, mind in nature, the basis for pantheistic thinking, one reality of deity and mind in nature, one universal principle, life immutable and unconscious in eternity until the essence of every atom of matter is lit up in mind in the human state. Now, I'm sure that you arrived this morning with your own thoughts on the subject, and I'll be getting technological support in being able to moderate discussion among the many of us. SL?
So in this presentation, we had very systematically outlined for us the emergence of mind from within that absolute, and it's the fact that all evolution, especially in the lower kingdoms, proceeds through this universal mind, through natural impulse. So the question rises, as self-conscious thinkers, do we have any role in all of this? Is our evolution just our own, or can we somehow influence, either assist or retard this unfolding of evolution in nature?
The role of mind, spirit, and human state is all-encompassing. When we think about the Gita, one interpretation of the Gita is that that great dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna is symbolic of the dialogue of soul, spirit, and the human mind within each one of us. Krishna being that eternal, immutable, eternal pilgrim, shining over and using the physical form, the personality, the lower brain, the lower mind that we're aware of when incarnate in flesh. If we follow the logical conclusion, the reasoned faith of that proposition, then all of this tremendous potentiality and potency of great nature, of the universal oversoul, the universal mind, all of that power in that homogeneity can be channeled by the self-conscious entity. As spirit soul, as the eternal pilgrims, our duty is to become aware of that true identification of the nature of self, to align ourselves with that reality as much as we can 24/7. Why? Because we are transmitters, we are the conduits, we are the great influencers, we are the points of apprenticeship of the great architect of the entire universe. And as self-conscious entity with the full mind powers, soul powers of intuition, of creative imagination, of will, of honing desire to be at one with the absolute, absolute compassion, we can influence all of great nature, lift it up, retard it, or even destroy the expression of it. Theosophy Hall.
Okay, there's two hands here.
Sure. If universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, then how do we account for things, the prevalence of poisonous plants, Venus flytraps, and great cataclysms like tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes? What theosophically can we say in regards to those natural disasters?
Natural disasters, even the striking of lightning in the neighborhood. There is a cycle to life, isn't there? And we can see it in all forms, except possibly the rocks that have endured everything. We see a birth, we see a limited endurance, the culmination of bloom, great strength, great beauty, and then a gradual decline, and then we see death. So that when we're thinking about this cyclic presentation of the universe, the coming forth of a universe, following a sine wave curve, hitting a crescendo, coming to a transition or critical state, and the declining, disappearing into a period of rest. We know there have to be natural mechanisms within which karmic law can operate and that can be used. So when we're considering the fact that to sustain physical life, the Venus flytrap needs nutrition, there's a sacrificial bond between the sustenance taken in, the creative life of the one that's using that energy level. But we know also with all great cataclysms, and we can think of wildfires in natural settings where there's been a bloom of vegetation maybe for hundreds of years, but it's now stymied, it's now stagnant. It has overrun the environment, and it's beginning its decline. The destruction of a cataclysm like a wildfire is one that will eliminate the dross, set an equal and even playing field for the seeding of new growth. And so we see the beginning of activity, the waning of activity, the cessation of that activity, why? To make room for the next cycle of manifestation and potentiality and growth. Another hand in Theosophy Hall?
Yes, in the back there.
So, when we're looking at the mind in nature, then, is the mind in nature a manifestation of universal oversoul, or are they one in the same?
Well, we have the great mystery of mind. We have the universality of Oversoul, one and the same, like electricity. It's one power, if you will, one potentiality. It is changeless. It emanates, comes forth, and is limited only by the condition through which it can shine. So it's all one and the same, but like light passing through a prism, we get an array of effects, an array of sensations that we can observe, a seven prismatic range, if you will, that then is sevened and sevened until we have this multitude of nuance and trace of color. Same way in the lower kingdoms. One life, one mind, passing through the prism or conditioning of the mineral or the vegetable or the animal or the human until it becomes particularized and expressed as best can be in that particular instrument. SL?
To go back to the previous question about how can there be destructive cataclysms and also violence and apparent violence in nature if universal brotherhood's a fact of nature. Well, wouldn't another name for universal brotherhood be the fact of everything being one and interdependent for good or evil? I mean, what improves one improves all. What hurts one hurts all, and vice versa.
So that mutual interdependence, sometimes we hear that stated as web of life, that there is no point in the cosmos, the universe, great nature, that is not interrelated or interactive with all other points. And it takes us back to the role, the Dharma, of mind working through the human state. We can all too sadly recognize and agree that when a human being chooses to abuse a particular animal form, a particular dog breed, what starts out as a natural breed, a natural expression of life force, can be perverted, can be twisted, can be made violent by the way in which a self-conscious entity, the human, interacts and trains that particular breed. In essence, the source of mind in that breed was one with nature, had certain natural instincts, only to eat when hungry, only to eat when needing to nourish its young to survive. But that natural impulse can be horribly twisted by the workings of evil, evil choice, evil will, evil behavior by a self-conscious entity. And we can begin to expand that in many, many ways. In our study of it, in the elimination of that possibility within our own use of mind and spirit and soul. Theosophy Hall.
So the viciousness of nature comes from where?
I missed the first part of
The viciousness of nature comes from where? Where is its source?
Oh, it seemed to this student, and we'll open this up for forum in a couple of seconds. It seems that the source of viciousness is in the thought patterns of the self-conscious entity in the human state. It is in the willful human state where free will and choice exists, where it's possible to reason from premise to conclusion, but start with the wrong premise. And therefore, it is in that self-conscious state where choices can be made that create dis-ease in the harmony of great nature. And that misapplication of identifying with the body, the brain, I, me, my, that selfishness, that divisiveness, that force for I'm okay, the rest of you are idiots, that kind of thinking is the source of viciousness. It's in a misapplication of mind in the self-conscious entity, and it's something that each one of us has to be on guard for. You know, in today's world, it's so easy to fall into the trap of observing behavior of other human beings and beginning to be judgmental, condemning what we see, reacting emotionally and having very harsh feelings toward another whose actions we don't agree with. That's the beginning of the seeds of causeless hate and viciousness. If we can use our minds, if we can raise the use of mind away from that illusion of separateness, that sin of separateness, if we can begin to develop character that identifies with the universal divine, that identifies with harmony, and what is it that we best do to serve the empowerment of mind in all matter in all states, then we begin to eradicate viciousness at all levels. SL?
It seems that viciousness is a moral quality that pertains to the human kingdom. So what we wonder is the natural observation of a chain of predator and victim, or predator, a chain of predator from the highest to the lowest in the kingdoms and all the kingdoms. Could this not rather be an expression of the law of sacrifice, the lower sacrificing to the higher, and the higher requiring the sacrifice of the lower in order to raise everything up? So it was mentioned before about interpretation. So we don't have to see nature as being vicious like ourselves, but rather expressing a universal law of harmony and sacrifice, one for all type of thing.
Yeah. The sacrifice of one for all. The collectivity, the communion, if you will, of life. And again, we're reminded that gluttony, for example, only exists in the human state. In the natural state, there is this instinctual sacrifice of the lower to the higher. The higher organism only takes in what is absolutely necessary. And there can even be a chain of sharing where if a weaker, injured animal is taken down by a predator, the predator and its pack will take what is needed and leave the rest for other predatory types that are not as strong, but indeed have to feed their own young and continue the role of life. But again, it's only in the human state that we begin to make judgments about what is fair and what is true, what is good, what is bad. It's in the human self-entity where mind is a moral force of life. It's not in the lower kingdoms. I have a little call for help. I have no clock in my office. It just dawned on me. So I will need a timer to tell me when it's...
We'll give you a 1 or 2 minute warning.
Thank you very much.
Sure. You're good. We're good to go.
SL?
So the principle's been established that mind is unfolding itself across time, and it expresses in the appropriate kingdom and appropriate species according to the development of that species. But we wonder, would that also mean that over the course of time, just as the human constitution and form evolves, in the far distant future, wouldn't the very form and nature of the animal, vegetable, and mineral be evolved as well in its sensitivity and its intelligence, even the way it reproduces and sustains itself? Wouldn't they become, well, we won't say more spiritual, but more refined in their qualities?
Well, we certainly see throughout the scientific investigation that there's an entire range of potentiality in animal and vegetable states, and that there is evolution across time. We recognize the physical form begins to adapt and respond to environment. But what has come to mind is that the premise that in universal mind, the tremendous mystery behind all of great nature is that the overarching design of life and the forms to come remain in the astral and are gradually used in succession appropriate to the development of mind and soul in any one state. So we know, for instance, from all of the ancient legends that the human state we're using right now today was not always the form that was used by self-conscious entity on this planet. And there's all sorts of research that each one of us could do about the various states along the evolutionary path to the human form that we're using presently. So too, mind will continue to use those forms that are most appropriate throughout cycles of existence and endurance. And we can project that in eons to come, in periods of duration to come, soul, spiritual mind will continue to use variants of forms and will find expression appropriate to that plane and state and round and race as appropriate to that time. So the forms can change. The life force is eternal and changeless. It will be able to express more and more. It's like the electricity that will express itself in a particular degree of light bulb wattage, but may be from time to time limited or hampered or even enlarged by the use of a shade, an angle, multiplicity of light bulbs. There's all different variations that can be happening. So form will continue to change. Mind will be gaining expression and therefore experience as these instruments change as well. Theosophy Hall.
So the animal kingdom immediately below us, they have mind and instincts, and they have all the principles really, but the self-consciousness has not expressed itself yet, but will in future periods of evolution. So we were just wondering, how can we best help to lift those forms up? Of course, we stop hurting them and stop abusing them. That's the first step. I mean, many of us have cats and dogs and horses and other animals, and they've been domesticated. You can't just let them out in the wild because, you know,
they're not wild.
They're not wild. They're part of our lives. But we're just wondering, how can we, is there any way we can elevate those, try to elevate those life forms, or not? Or are we just nothing we can do?
Well, as we are thinkers, and we're using this great mind of nature, we can alter our use of mind toward the animal state, the plant state, in the mundane moments of life. If we have companion animals in our homes, we can make life as comfortable as possible. We can think and voice and act as kindly as possible. We can support as natural an environment as possible for those companion animals. As thinkers, we can begin the long journey away from food addictions and automatic behaviors around food and begin to be concerned with, if life is sacrificial and I'm using food to sustain energy, how do I best do that efficiently to maintain health and sound state of mind? What choices can I make about the foods that I take into the physical form? What foods are necessary for this particular physical form at whatever stage of decay it's in? And then begin to make those decisions. Do I support organic farming only? Do I support a particular vegan, vegetarian, carnivore, balanced, omnivore kind of diet? What is best for the physical frame? All the while maintaining the wisdom and the insight that this is a sacrificial chain, that as I begin to use food during the course of a day, if I'm demanding that these lower kingdoms sacrifice for the use of this body, then this body, this brain, this personality needs to sacrifice and support the wellness of the whole, of the universality of mind and nature.
Thank you. Well, we have
incidental thought.
Just a 1 minute warning, that's all.
Oh, 1 minute warning. SL, you had a quick hand, and then I've got a short no.
Just one minute warning. You were also.
Oh, thank you. I need it desperately.
There is a hand here if we can slide.
Real fast.
Real fast.
Little
mind and nature, we have sort of lost our connection with nature in itself. What does nature have to offer us to put us back on the right track?
Nature will continue to give us insight and wake-up calls on how to set harmonious life all over again. We will experience feedback in the way of calamity. We will experience feedback in the way of droughts, if you will. And these are all wake-up calls that something is askew and something needs to be adjusted. As we take down the rainforests in South America, nature will have a wake-up call about the use of oxygen on the planet. As we eliminate the ability of butterflies and fish and birds to migrate because they're too confused by Wi-Fi signaling, radio signaling, we'll learn how to better support the environment. And then in turn, as we begin to improve, great nature will rise up to assist in the entire process. And so we'd like to close with a reading of the Kuan Yin pledge about how best we can serve mind in nature. Never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation. Never will I enter into final peace alone, but forever and everywhere will I live and strive for the redemption of every creature throughout the world from the bonds of conditioned existence. So here's to the rocks, here's to the plants, here's to the animals. Have a great day. See you Wednesday.